everyone's fond of saying that coastlines and forest distributions and all this stuff are fractal. Well, doesn't this imply that there is then a global fractal? There is a fractal dimension which, when you feed it into your computer and wrap the data around a sphere, the continents and oceans of Earth should appear. And in principle, again, to the absurd level, you should be able to then telescope in on that portion of this data that is wrapped around the sphere that corresponds to Northern California. And on your computer screen should appear Esalen hung on the cliffs of Big Sur with us sitting in a room inside discussing the matter.
Rupert, Terence, I'm Ralph. Creation, imagination, my mask is chaos.
LSD experiences, I seemed to see motifs and structures that gave me an interest in Tibetan Buddhism. And I went to India with the intent of studying the Tibetan language and quickly found that the whole thing was just overwhelming. And that I was just, you know, a human atom in the sea of India, and that the notion of encompassing or understanding what this was clearly the task of a lifetime. And several times in my life I have acted out this sort of ricocheting relationship between the humanities and the sciences, at times, you know, losing myself in the study of certain schools of poetry or literature or painting, and then at other times spending years reading philosophy of science and epistemic basis of physics and this sort of thing, always trying to get a resolution on the content of my experience, my lived experience, which included the psychedelic experience, which for me from very early on was this kind of tremendous mystery or conundrum which was set down in the middle of my being. And it still continues like that. I keep returning to that, testing all the ideas against the fullness of experience. The main difference between our world and the world that science tells us we're living in is that science denies the quirky, freaky, cosmic giggle, high plottedness, completely improbable, totally quirky humor that binds everything together and that makes it something other than an engine in which atoms blindly run, in Whitehead's phrase. Schrodinger brilliantly anticipated the discovery of DNA, and then Joseph Needham and L.L. White, and, Eric Jansch should be mentioned, actually, as a precursor of us all, I think. I mean, Eric Jansch was a great pioneer, a great soul, and he saw very deeply into whole systems, as did Ilya Prigozhin, the Belgian thermodynamicist. And I think a lot of all of what we're doing comes out of that. What Prigozhin showed that just brought down the house was that there could be perturbations of physical systems that were unpredictable and that would cause the whole system to actually move to a more ordered state than the initial state. And this perturbation to higher states of order looks suspiciously like a violation of the supposedly inviolate second law of thermodynamics. So that looks, you know, like a doorway into an energetic hyperspace.
Well, when A New Science of Life came out in 1982 in America, it came out a year earlier in England. I came to California because it was published in Los Angeles. I found myself here at Esalen. I found an extraordinary new range of things going on I hadn't known about. And when I was in San Francisco, a friend who I knew from Europe said to me, just the day before I left, there's somebody you must meet. He's called Terence McKenna. I didn't know much about Terence, so I went up there. And in this large 1956 Buick, we headed off into the woods in Sonoma County, where Terence lives. And there I met both Terence and Ralph, who was there for the day. I found that part of my interest in these other realms of reality, of course, like many people in this room, was stimulated by experience with psychedelic substances. This was before I went to India. When I arrived in India, I found that India is a kind of psychedelic realm anyway. You know, it's just an amazing place. So in Terence, I found somebody who knew about that whole realm, who shared with me an interest in India, since it played an important part in his development, and who had views about the nature of reality which complemented my own in an extraordinary way. My own theory is about memory and habit in nature. Terence, I found, had developed a theory about novelty and creativity in nature, a theory about the quality of time and the creative process as it is related to the ongoing flux of events. And Ralph had a kind of mathematical theory, which was just the kind of thing that the view of nature I was trying to develop needed, the idea of nature being drawn by goals or attractors. In the mathematical science of dynamics, there's this model of of reality being pulled from ahead by things called attractors. It's a teleological, animistic view of nature, which dressed up in the guise of mathematical models, which I found most fascinating. And so for me, the meeting with Ralph and Terence was a step further towards seeing how one could begin to dream of a world in which nature was seen as alive, in which the imagination permeated all reality, in which animals and plants are seen as part of the living texture, the living components, the cells in the life of Gaia, and Gaia in the life of the cosmos as a whole. In fact, a view of the world as alive, which recalls in some respects the old cosmologies of the ancient world, where the cosmos was seen as a living organism, where they thought of the whole cosmos as having a soul, the soul of the world, the anima mundi.
So I was brought up in a field of music, but I was attracted to mathematics early. And when I was 14, I played in the State Symphony. After that, I started in mathematics, and I became a professor at Berkeley when I was 23. I had an easy way in mathematics, and the way the system works, the carpet is unrolled in front of you. You know, you have a few choices, but basically, before you even know what's happening, the carpet is unrolled, and you're down the runnel into whatever you can do that's useful to the system. In this process, I lost nature, but there was a great gain because I love it out there. I love to be off the planet. I always did, and to this day, I spend very little time on planet Earth. So it went on in this way, and by 1967, I was a professor at Princeton. I had written three books on mathematics that you need a microscope to read. And I had been studying for a long while chaos, but we didn't call it chaos then, and we didn't see in it any role in the natural world or in social transformation or in the evolution of consciousness, because we didn't think about anything out there. So one day after my third book was done and I was exhausted and I looked up and all the students were out in the courtyard demonstrating about the Vietnam War and to open the university to women students and so on. I said, what exactly is going on? Here, they said, take this. And so, like many people in that year or around that time, in 1967, my career had a bifurcation. So I went off the track with psychedelics, with meditation, but especially with searching, with trying everything. And eventually I was living in a cave in the Himalayas. And when I returned to California, I was standing on a street corner in Santa Cruz in white pajamas, and a car stopped. An old friend from a previous lifetime said, there's somebody you have to meet. Get in the car. I had nothing to do. It sounded okay, and in that time, I believed that everything goes perfectly. You just go along with the flow, as they said. I didn't know it would be a two-hour drive, so I got in the car. There was the two-hour drive to Berkeley, and I was literally dumped out of the car on Terrence's front step. I never heard of Terrence at that time, 1972. Mm-hmm. And I went in, and what happened then, I would still say, although we've had many wonderful talks and exciting, thrilling, and nutritious times in the meanwhile, that was quite a miraculous chat. Many subjects came up. How to grow mushrooms, outer space, I don't know, anything you could think of, all passed by in the course of an hour or two. In this way, we became friends, and this habit we had, this activity that we do, I mean, we never go for a hike or something like that. We sit in the evening and talk, and what happens is synergistic, miraculous growth, evolutionary. And in this revitalization of my work, and eventually the whole field of mathematics, my conversations with Terrence, whereas I think we thought of them as just good fun, that they did have a really fundamental influence on everything I've done since. So fun, or I would say fun is insulting, I mean thrilling, because of going to the edge, going beyond the edge, having company there, finding things which you can bring back and they work, and become part of everything you're doing. So it's opened up. These complex phenomenon characterized by chaotic, irregular, that is to say not well ordered in the previous paradigm of space-time structure. For example, relationships among people, the states and change of states of society, the whole process of history, the intuitive experience, subjective experience of relationship and so on. All of this, what we always wanted, to come under the view of a better understanding, suddenly is possible. But although it's possible, it's not done. But we can do it. So we can try to do it.
The flutter of the moth's wing can trigger the hurricane. This is not a poetic statement. This is the fact of the matter within this kind of description of nature. In other words, very small changes create cascades into where whole states shift and are perturbed. And this is the kind of situation that we are facing as a society and a planetary species. We have the resources. We have the knowledge, but what we seem to lack is the will to implement these things, to actually step back from the abyss. So it has to come through a change of mind. And this new mathematical stuff is telling us that the intimations of mysticism, the intimation of a possibility of transcendence, is all firmly grounded. We just have to now, it's almost as though mathematics is the extreme cutting edge of human understanding. How can we quickly export these new understandings that release us from a need for closure, that free us from an either-or universe? How can we quickly export these models from the realm of research mathematics into the realm of daily life? I really see it as politics, almost at the viral level, that we are trying to create new languages and new concepts, and not only create them, but teach them to you, and we ourselves repeat them over and over again, and you feed back into this, and then we refine the meme, and then a meme is like a gene. It can be replicated. And we have not seen language as the playing field of the creation of the new paradigm, but that's really where it is. We can transform ourselves no more quickly than we transform our language. And the way we transform our language is by really pushing on the envelope of the act of communication. You know, the caterpillar in Alice in Wonderland says, "Say what you mean and mean what you say. I do."
I'm a biologist by background. I studied biology because I was interested in animals and plants. And when I was studying it at Cambridge, I began to have terrible doubts about what I was doing, because everything that really interested me about animals and plants somehow vanished when I got into the biochemistry laboratories. I was majoring in biochemistry, and I did a PhD in biochemistry there. But there's a curious thing about biochemistry. You're doing biochemistry to study the molecular basis of life. Yet the very first thing you do in the laboratory is kill whatever you're studying, grind it up, extract the enzymes, and then in a test tube study the properties of some of these molecules extracted from this killed organism. And it began to occur to me that perhaps this wasn't the best way to understand life. But I didn't quite know what to do about it, because everybody else thought it definitely was the best way to study life, and in fact there was no other valid way. So this set me thinking, and I began to see that the science of biology could be reformed, that this idea that living organisms are truly alive rather than being just machines — that's the official doctrine, the mechanistic theory says living organisms are just complicated machines. Believe it or not, still the official doctrine of academic biology and academic medicine. These ideas went on developing. I then saw how I could bring them all together in a synthesis and into a new way of seeing how biology could be done. And I wrote a book while still in India called A New Science of Life. In it, the basic idea I'm suggesting is that there's a kind of inherent memory in all kinds of animals and plants. Each species has its own collective memory. So each member of the species draws on this collective memory and in turn contributes to it. The instincts of animals, for example, the behavior of cuckoos, the spinning of webs by spiders, are like a memory, a habit of the species. This inheritance takes place by the process I call morphic resonance, by a kind of invisible, intangible memory, a kind of resonance between present and past organisms of the same kind. The same theory helps explain how our own memory works, by a resonance between our own past and our present states, leads to the idea that our memories aren't stored in our brains, but that we're tuning into them by this process of morphic resonance.
Rupert's notions, revision causality, that means induct you into an entirely new way in which things happen. And this is, after all, where we're all spending a lot of our time. The models that Ralph is working with show that the world is not an engine running down toward a heat death, but a tremendous kaleidoscope of unpredictable, creative, open-ended activity on every level. I mean, it's really a dazzlingly kaleidoscopic vision. It's like a Sufi herophony or something, but we're seeing it on the screens of computer simulations of this mathematical domain that is also the neural domain, that is also the social domain, that is also the eco-planetary domain. This is not error. This is not mysticism. This is the real facts of how it is, how the world fits together. It fits together through the infusion of its invisible soul.
If nature is evolutionary, if all of nature is evolving, what about the eternal laws of nature, which scientists have taken for granted for so many centuries, concepts going right back to Pythagoras and the ancient Greeks? Were all the laws of nature there before the Big Bang? Well, if they were there before the Big Bang, where could they possibly be? There was nowhere to be, there was no universe. So if the laws of nature were all there before the Big Bang, then they must be non-physical, idea-like entities dwelling in some kind of permanent mathematical mind, be that thought of as the mind of God or just the mind of a kind of disembodied mathematician. They were thought to be permanent and all there before the universe. This assumption is still held by most of our modern cosmologists. It's something that physicists have not yet begun to question seriously. But as you can see, it's like an idea that's had the carpet taken from under it. It's sort of hanging over an abyss. Because there's no real reason why we should assume the laws of nature are permanent in an evolving universe. If the universe is evolving, then the laws of nature could be evolving as well. And in fact, the very idea of the laws of nature may not be appropriate. It may be better to think of the habits of nature evolving. The Big Bang is like the cracking of the cosmic egg. That's its mythological correlate, the notion of the ancient mythological idea of the cosmos beginning through the hatching or the cracking of an egg, followed by the growth of the organism that comes out. It's an embryological metaphor. And we now have a kind of developmental model of the whole universe. It's like a developing organism. It's not like a machine at all anymore. The universe is a growing, developing organism, which is differentiating within itself, forming new forms and patterns, an evolutionary process that on Earth has given rise to all the forms of animal and plant life, all the different kinds of microbes, to ourselves, and to the many and varied forms of human culture. A theory of evolutionary habits demands a theory of evolutionary creativity. How can we understand the creativity that's given rise to new ideas, to Beethoven's symphonies, to theories in science, to new works of art, to new forms of culture, to instincts in birds and animals, to the forms of flowers and plants and leaves, to the many kinds of rocks and crystals, and to all the forms of galactic and stellar and planetary organization? What kind of creativity could underlie all those processes? One is the materialist view that says the whole thing is entirely due to blind chance, that there's nothing but a kind of darkness of blind material processes going on, and then by blind chance, new things happen. The other model for understanding creativity, I think, is provided by our own imaginations. Our imaginations are not full of fixed Platonic ideas, which are always the same, like Platonic minds. They're ongoing, changing, dynamical processes with a kind of creative richness that always surprises us. So the question is, if nature is alive rather than dead, if the universe, if the earth, have a kind of mind or soul of their own, if living organisms are in some sense mind-like, or if there's a mind-like process at work in nature, then how does it express its creativity? And so then the question is, could this creativity in nature be a product of the imagination of Gaia, of the Gaian mind? Could it be a product of the cosmic imagination? Could there be a kind of imagination working in nature, which is similar to our own imaginations? Could our own imaginations be just one conscious aspect of an imagination working through the whole natural world, perhaps unconsciously as it works underneath the surface of our dreams, perhaps sometimes consciously. And could this ongoing imagination be the basis of evolutionary creativity in nature, just as it is in the human realm?
Better on down.
Hello, Houston. Suite 16 has arrived.
How would it be, or is it credible, that perhaps what the universe is a kind of system in which more advanced forms of order actually influence previous states of organization? This is what is emerging in Ralph Abraham's work with the chaotic attractors. They are attractors. That means that they exert influence on less organized states and pull them toward some kind of end state. And for me, the key to unlocking what is going on with history, creativity, progressive process of all sorts is to place the state of completion at the end, but to see it as a kind of higher dimensional object which casts an enormous and flickering shadow over the lower dimensions of organization, of which this universe is one. So that, for instance, in the human domain, when we look at history, what we see is an endless series of anticipations. The golden age is coming. The Messiah is immediately around the corner. Great change is soon to be upon us. These are intimations of change. It's almost as though the transcendental object that is the great attractor in many, many dimensions throws out images of itself, which filter down through these lower dimensional matrices and actually are the basis of the appetition of nature for greater expression of form, the appetition of the human soul for greater immersion in beauty, the appetition of human history for greater expression of complexity. So when I think about these terms, chaos, creativity, imagination, I see them, it's like a three-stroke engine of some sort. Each impels and runs the other and sets up a reinforcing cycle that then stabilizes organisms, processes that are caught up in this, in the phenomenon of being. The phenomenon of being is this self-synergizing engine of out of chaos, through creativity, into the imagination, back into chaos, out into creativity, so forth and so on. And it operates on many levels simultaneously, so that the planet is undergoing a destiny. Deep time, the time of geology, was only really discovered around the turn of this century. And it is cosmically ennobling to think of the universe as a thing of great age, but I think that it's time to put in place, next to the notion of deep cosmic time, the notion of chaotic, sudden change, cusp flux, and sudden perturbation. Because what deep time has revealed, as we've pushed our understanding of the career of organic life back 65 million years, 270 million years, what we see is tremendous punctuation built into the universe, in the case of the Earth, in the form of asteroidal impacts. This thing which happened 65 million years ago, nothing larger than a chicken walked away from it on this planet. So there's a strange paradox where taking deep time seriously, the message of deep time is you may not have as much time as you thought, that the universe is dynamic, capable of turning sudden corners. So then the imagination becomes a kind of beacon. The imagination is, as it were, a scout sent ahead, or something which has preceded us into history, and in fact is a kind of eschatological object. It is shedding influence, the morphogenetic field, if you wish. If the morphogenetic field is not subject to the inverse square law of decreased influence over distance, then I, as a layman, don't see why, Rupert, we couldn't locate it at the conclusion of process. Because, you know, one of the things that's always puzzled me about the Big Bang is it's a singularity. This is the term physicists use for it. This means theory cannot predict it, and yet it is necessary to make everything which follows from it happen. So you just say, you know, there's no reason for this, we have no argument for this, but the rest of the theory needs it. So it's a singularity, and the immense improbability which modern science rests on but cares not to discuss is this: the belief that the universe sprang from nothing in a single moment. Well, if you can make that leap to believe that, it's very hard to see what you couldn't believe. That is almost the limiting case of credulity, I would think, you know? So, so in order to save the phenomenon, I would propose a different idea that, I think it is eminently reasonable, and it is that as the complexity of a system increases, so too does the likelihood of its generating a singularity or an unpredictable perturbation. So the pre-existent state of the universe, I imagine to be extremely simple, an unflawed nothingness. In other words, the least likely situation in which you would expect a singularity to emerge. But now let's look at the other end of the historical continuum of the history of the universe. Let's look at the world we are living in, which is full of 106 elements, tremendous gradients of energy ranging from what's going on inside pulsars and quasars to what is going on inside viruses and cells, tremendous organizational capacity at the atomic level, at the molecular level, at the level of molecular polymerization, at the level of membranes and gels, at the level of cells and organelles, organisms, societies, so forth and so on. In other words, the universe at this moment is a tremendously complicated, integrated, multi-leveled, dynamic thing. And every passing moment, it becomes more so. This is what evolution, history, compression of time, what all these things are attempting to indicate, is the increasing complexity of reality. If a singularity is necessary to explain this universe, that singularity must emerge rather near the end of the complexification process rather than its beginning. You see, we simply have to reverse our preconceptions about the flow of cause and effect, and then we get a great attractor that pulls all organization and structure toward itself over several billion years, and as the objects of its attraction grow closer to its proximity, they somehow interpenetrate. They set up standing wave patterns of interference. New properties become emergent, and the entire thing complexifies. Well, to my mind, this is the divine imagination. This is what Blake called it. This is the only way I can conceive of it. Time is the theater of God's becoming, but it's also, from the point of view of a higher dimensional manifold, a kind of fait accompli. And this is no contradiction, or if it is, it's all right, because in these realms of higher ontology,